like to invite you into a time of silent prayer or meditation with these words from the Reverend Charles Gaines. How quiet it is when we have the patience to be silent. How much we can learn in moments like these. We can learn to have patience with ourselves, to better understand and like who we are. We can learn to have patience with others, to better listen to what they say and how they feel. We can learn to have patience with life, to better work with it rather than against it. How much do we need silence? Silence for truth, so that we may learn wisdom. Silence for wisdom, so that we may love. Silence for love, so that we may be just. Silence for justice, so that we may live fully. May we be more patient and more silent, so that we may proceed with courage and compassion.
Good morning. I'd like to share with you a reading by John Patrick Shanley. What is doubt? Each of us is like a planet. There is a crust which seems eternal. We are confident about who we are. If you ask, we can readily describe our current state. I know my answers to so many questions, as do you. What was your father like? Do you believe in God? Who's your best friend? What do you want? Your answers are your current topography, seemingly permanent, but deceptively so, because under the face of each easy response, there is another you. And this wordless being moves just as the instant moves. It presses upward without explanation, fluid and wordless, until the resisting consciousness has no choice but to give way. It is doubt, so often experienced initially as weakness, that changes things. When a man feels unsteady, when he falters, when hard-won knowledge evaporates before his eyes, he's on the verge of growth. The subtle or violent reconciliation of the outer person and the inner core often seems at first like a mistake, like you've gone the wrong way and you're lost. But this is just emotion longing for the familiar. Life happens when the tectonic power of your speechless soul breaks through the dead habits of the mind. Doubt is nothing less than an opportunity to re-enter the present. When I first had the idea for this particular talk, I ran it by my partner, Scott. And he looked a little befuddled at first, like the RCA Victor dog or something, with his head cocked sideways. So I explained it to him again, and all he said was, "Well, it sounds a little heady to me, Michael, but I'm sure you'll bring it down into some human terms, and it'll be just great." So with that vote of confidence, I find myself here, but I am keeping my eye peeled for the head cocked sideways. But the way I see it, this is about as basic as it gets. What do we believe? What do we hold to be true? What's the primary lens through which we view the bigger questions about life and death? What's it all about, Alfie? As Unitarian Universalists, we tend to keep those questions at the forefront, encouraging our own individual and collective exploration for answers, while other faith traditions offer up answers and demand, in varying degrees, adherence to that point of view. What I have found, though, in my work as an oncology chaplain is that we may think we know what we believe, but when it gets right down to it, where the theology meets the road, when faced with a crisis like cancer, critical illness, or death, often all bets are off. I've been with dozens of devout Christians, Catholics, who, when faced with the end, will admit, "I don't know what comes next. I'd like to believe in heaven, sure, but I really don't know." Likewise, I've been with plenty of secular folks who, when faced with a finish line, will admit, They can't quite accept that this is the whole story. They will sometimes share with me mystical experiences they've had that they claim they've never shared with anyone. Perhaps it just didn't toe the secular party line, or maybe they just didn't have a context in which to hold such an experience. Sometimes faith systems remain whole, complete, intact. Sometimes they collapse altogether. And sometimes they just crack open the teeniest bit, allowing room for an often disquieting visitor, doubt. That's the intersection I wanted to explore this morning. You see, just as patients have to hold those huge questions of what do I really believe now when it gets down to it, so it is that I have to hold those questions as I walk beside them. And my hope and invitation to you is that perhaps some of these reflections will resonate and reverberate, even though crisis may be at bay, for now. There are a handful of theological themes that I see come up again and again from folks all over the belief spectrum, from evangelical Christians to secular humanists and everyone in between. And as I explore these, I do see the irony that I'm even attempting to come up with something vaguely universal here, when, if anything, I deplore the idea of singular universal truth, but there you are. Still, I'd like to believe there may be something universally human here that has room in it for contradiction, paradox, and doubt. John Patrick Shanley, who's a playwright and wrote that reading I read earlier, he wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning play called Doubt. He says that the opposite of faith isn't doubt, it's certainty. And certainty is certainly one of the themes that I see come up again and again. I know this to be true. I know that God loves me and hears my prayer and there's a place for me in heaven. I know that God doesn't give us any more than we can handle. I know that God helps those who help themselves. That's often attributed to the Bible, but actually that's Benjamin Franklin. Or in a different vein, I know that my thought creates my reality. I know that everything happens for a reason. I know that what goes around comes around. Or in a different vein, I know that there is no truth beyond science. I know that there is no law beyond nature. I know that there is no reality beyond this one. The fact is, using illustrations from patients' lives, I could make a fairly good case for the truth or falsehood of any one of those statements of faith. Prove them or disprove them, if you will. But to what end? It's not a court case. Judith Meyer, who retired from our pulpit a number of years ago in Santa Monica, used to begin every Sunday morning by reminding us we're here to practice what it means to be human. And to me, there is something fundamentally human in the way that we crave and pursue and take comfort in our certainty, often while we often miss the magic of its collapse. When I first walked into Stan's room, he was alone in the bed, sitting up with an oxygen mask on. I introduced myself as the chaplain, and he waved me away right away rather dismissively, but not without first lifting up his mask and spitting out as quickly and precisely as possible in a near singular breath, "I know the Lord Jesus Christ is my personal Savior, and by his stripes I shall be healed. Thank you so much for coming." And he put the mask back down. Stan's a perfect example of what I've come to call shrink-wrap theology. I've seen dozens like him. And not just religious folks, secular folks too. It's as if he's wrapped so tightly in his beliefs, in his theology, that he remains as impenetrable as a new CD. Some might say that his faith is so strong that he's all set, that he'll be just fine. And that may be, mechanically speaking anyway, and if everything goes well. But one could also say that the full breadth and depth of his journey through cancer is lost on him. He remains impervious to it. There is no room whatsoever for awakening, for discovery, for revelation, even for transformation. I could also hear a certain distress in the way he clung to that certainty, much in the same way that there was distress in his body clinging to the oxygen coming from that mask. As if that belief were another kind of mask. Javier was a young man in his 30s, leukemia diagnosis. The kind of a patient who, once I introduced myself to him, he kind of wanted to show off for me a little bit, spiritually speaking, to show me how spiritually solid he was. So he showed me his Bible, and he showed me his books, and he showed me all of his CDs, and he told me about his church community. While he'd grown up in a large Latino Catholic family, as an adult, he'd found a greater connection to a more evangelical Christian community. So he used a lot of language like, as the head of the house, I want to walk with the Lord, and I want to surround myself with the right kinds of people. My brother is just not right with the Lord, no matter what I say to him, and so I just can't have him in my life anymore, Michael. His faith was in his certainty. Still, I could hear a certain unease beneath his platitudes, and I asked him to tell me more about what he meant by the right kinds of people. And I asked him to consider if he thought Jesus would make such distinctions. Well, that opened the conversation wide. And then we could really talk about his judgments of others, but more importantly, his judgments toward himself. And finally, 45 minutes later, the truth could finally come seeping out in his tears, beneath his mask of certainty, when he said, to tell you the truth, Michael, I don't think I'm going to make it. And I don't deserve this. Wow. It was like this enormous exhale after holding his breath for as long as humanly possible. And what was left was room to breathe in another kind of air that I would just as soon call grace to be who he is. A scared human being with far more questions than answers. Deserving, it is such a loaded word, and yet is inextricably linked with all these other themes that I see come up again and again. Closely linked to deserving is the idea that I'm special. I'm special, and therefore I'm entitled to good things, to health, success, to love, to salvation, whatever it is. Closely linked to deserving, but in slight contrast to being entitled or special, is the idea that good things have to be earned, that I must prove myself worthy in order to have success, health, salvation, whatever it is. Now, while that idea may seem to be shot through the lens of some Protestant work ethic, that idea is also present in Eastern thought and religion. It's also present in New Age thought, and it's certainly present in American secular humanist tradition in the way that we revere self-made men and women. They earned it, by golly. Closely linked to earning is the idea that I have some power or control here over outcomes, that if I can do, be, say, pray, or eat the right thing, somehow I'll be okay. I'll be safe, and I'll be healed. And all of these ideas are huddled under the same umbrella of belief that would even say there is such a thing as a force for goodness and justice and love and fairness in the world. Now, I'm not here to suggest that any of these are the correct beliefs and should be encouraged and nurtured, or that they're misguided and should be avoided, or that I don't hold them myself, given the day that you ask me. I only mean to share that I see them revealed again and again in times of crisis from folks all over the belief map, even when, as in Javier's case, there are initially declarations to something quite different. Ultimately, it came down to, I don't deserve this. I also mean to caution that I think some of these ideas can trip us up, or more precisely, by how tightly we hold on to them. Phyllis was the embodiment of I am special. It was the end of the day on a Friday. I was pretty pooped, ready to go home, but I saw there was one newly admitted patient whom I'd not met, so I thought I'll just pop in and introduce myself before the weekend. Just opened the door, popped my head in a little bit, said, "Hi, I'm Michael, the chaplain," before she bellows out, "Oh, the Lord has truly answered my prayers in sending you here to me today. Please do come in and sit down." Oh, brother. How much theology is reflected in that one sentence alone? The Lord has answered my prayers in sending you here to me today. Well, Phyllis's spiritual crisis had not so much to do with her diagnosis or her prognosis so much as it had to do with her vocabulary. You see, on New Year's Day that year, she and her husband sat down to make a list of expectations they had of God. She felt uneasy with that word at first and said so. But her husband had assured her that God has expectations of us, and so we can have expectations of God. And so they made a list of things like success and wealth and happiness and all the rest. But now she wondered if she had offended God in using that word, and that's why she has leukemia. You see, Michael, my leukemia is 100% curable, so I think maybe God was just trying to get my attention, give me a slap on the wrist, you know what I mean? But I'm not sure. What if, God forbid, my leukemia were incurable? Do you think it'd be a punishment then? What do you think? I want to go home, is what I think. Phyllis went on to tell me how God had given her cuts in line at the supermarket and found parking places for her right by the front door of an impossibly crowded Costco parking lot. Do you know what prayer I pray every day, Michael? I say, God, show me your favor today. I just hate wishy-washy prayers, don't you? Why should God show you his favor, I asked. Because I'm his precious child. What about the last person in line at the supermarket? Is he God's precious child? Well, he may be, but God has his favorites. Jesus had his favorites. There's a hierarchy in heaven. It says so in the Bible. I want to be at the top. There you have it. I'm special. Now, as much of a cartoon as Phyllis may seem to be, I assure you her suffering is very real and human. And how many of us feel special? I do. Don't you? I'm a good guy. I'm a good friend. I devote a lot of my life to service. I eat right. I exercise. What if none of us are special at all? Or what if we all are? That second theme that would say that good things have to be earned, it's also closely linked to the idea that it's never here now in this moment available to us. It's over there. And you have to earn it. That somehow there's this place called joy, peace, happiness, health, and love. I'm going to work like a dog to get there. When I get there, I'm never going to move. Don't anybody touch anything. I'll be okay when. If I could just get that job, if I could just get that house, if that person would just love me, if that person would just go away, if I had just $1,000 more, if I can just get through this chemo, then I'll be okay. So many belief systems, secular and religious alike, are based on this idea that it's not here now, it's over there, and I have to earn it. Ruth was this wonderfully wise and soulful older woman with deep roots in her Eastern European Jewish ancestry. She was watching the love of her life, her husband of over 60 years, slowly slip away over the course of many weeks in the hospital. Michael, she said, I thought I did life the right way. I married the man I loved. We raised three beautiful children, gave them wonderful educations, and now they have great careers and families of their own. We were always looking forward to our golden years. And now look. To tell you the truth, I'm going to be 83 years old, and I'm still waiting for the party to begin. Myra was this great gal in her mid-50s. You might describe her as a firecracker. She had a pretty colorful past, a not-so-wonderful absent husband, and a very thick Long Island accent. I liked her very much. After about a half an hour of getting acquainted, I asked her if any kind of faith or spirituality were part of the equation for her. Oh, God, she said. Well, I was raised a Catholic, but I don't know. Church, it was never my thing. I mean, I believe in God and everything, but church, I don't know. And then I got sick, and I thought I should pray or something. But it seemed kind of hypocritical to go to God now when I hadn't gone to God after all these years. You know what I mean? And then last week, I was across the street in the clinic getting my chemo, and there was this Latino man there praying up a storm with the pictures of the rosary, the saints and the rosary beads and all of that. And I thought, I can't compete with that. As if it's a contest. As if there's only so much love, only so much healing, grace, compassion to go around. She wasn't entitled to her share. She hadn't done it the right way. Hadn't earned it. Alex was a very tough young man, 28 years old, with this native street smarts kind of intelligence, very turbulent background, grew up in the Central Valley of California, a history with gangs. He had a brother in prison. He was a semi-pro bare-fisted boxer. I didn't know such a thing even existed. And when I went into his room, the only personal artifact that was there was this tattered up picture of him bloodied up in the boxing ring. I didn't recognize him. I said, "What? Who's that a picture of?" He said, "It's me. It's the only time I ever lost a fight." "Why would you want that picture up?" I asked. "I want to be sure it never happens again." He had this amazing capacity for reflection and paradox and contradiction. A deep thinker. "Yeah, Michael, I could pray for God to heal me, but why should he? Why me? Why not the guy down the hall? Why not the kids downstairs, for Christ's sake? Why not the whole hospital? Isn't praying sort of judging God, saying things shouldn't be the way they are? Maybe we're supposed to accept." But then the champion in the ring let his voice be heard. "Michael, I want to be the best patient possible. You've seen hundreds of people go through these stem cell transplants. What's the best way to do this?" And there's that other theme. I have some power or control here over outcomes. Now, I don't mean to imply that we don't have power or control over the way we experience our journey and the meaning we find there. But when it comes to the big questions of who gets sick and who doesn't and who dies and who doesn't, it's just often out of our hands. And Alex did not want to accept that. He was in and out of the hospital for the better part of a year. And about a month in, his mother came to stay with him. And she became his rock and his warrior and his coach. She was also a devout evangelical Christian. And she saw to it right away that her boy got back right with the Lord. That ended our wonderfully complex conversations. This was particularly troubling for me because I have to confess I harshly judged that dualistic black and white kind of thinking. And yet that simplistic worldview did seem to bring Alex some comfort. And then I found myself wondering, well, is comfort the only goal here? What about growth and awakening? I don't know. One thing became crystal clear, is that nothing anyone could say or do or pray could alter the fact that the disease would take his life at 28 years old. Oh, well, everything happens for a reason, right? Maybe it's a blessing in disguise. The Lord works in mysterious ways. I believe in the power of love over darkness and fear and a loving God. What goes around comes around. I know that all of us have heard such statements of faith hundreds of times, perhaps coming out of our own mouths. I know I have. Even though any one of us I trust, but no one more than Alex, could make a fairly airtight case for just how untrue such notions could be. And yet our common human journey does seem to reach for and expect some sense of justice and fairness in the world, no matter how impossible to define, no matter how unattainable. Many years ago, I worked for a hospice. And there I met Loretta, who was the niece of the patient. She was his caregiver. And Loretta had the definitive opinion about everything. And she wasn't a bit shy about sharing it. "Michael, do you want to know what prayer I pray every day? I say, God, I know we are all your children, that we are all brothers and sisters under the skin, but God, some of your children, they need a spanking. They do. Wouldn't you like to see that, Michael? Wouldn't you like to see God just reach down from heaven and grab up Mr. George W. Bush by the britches and go pam, pam, pam like that on the booty? And say, you go sit over there now and think about what you've done." "I would. I think it should be on TV." Now, I'm not making this up. And yes, Loretta made me laugh. And yes, there's a hint of vindictiveness in her prayer. But there is also the struggle to claim the promise of justice. It's one of our foundational UU principles. Are we so different? Carlos was a beautiful young man, 31 years old, undergoing the rigors of an allogenic stem cell transplant, in his case, given chance of success at 20%. Toward the end, without a trace of self-pity and barely able to speak above a whisper, he said, "Well, Michael, if it's my time, it's my time, I guess. That's one way I look at it." "What's the other way?" I asked. He said, "Well, to have faith." "In what?" I asked. "In God, that God will heal me." And we looked at how those might not be either-or statements. How might, if it's my time, it's my time, be a statement of deep faith? Is our faith only to be measured by our attachment to outcomes? To me, it's a statement of a much deeper kind of faith, of being willing to step off into the unknown without any such attachment to outcomes or even to our notions of goodness and justice and fairness. So in the end, maybe I am special. Maybe I have earned it. God knows. Maybe I can create my reality through my affirmations and my thoughts, and maybe everything does happen for a reason, and maybe there is a force for love and justice and goodness in the world. And maybe there's not. I didn't set out to articulate the most correct theology, as if such a thing exists. In the end, I don't know that it even is so much about our theology so much as it is about our relationship to it, how tightly we hold on to it. I would ask myself, can I move into a deeper experience of serenity, of grace, through a fascination with the mystery that is greater than my need for any singular, concrete, solid truth, even if everything I have held to be true my entire life, when it gets right down to it, where the theology meets the road, turns out not to be true at all, or even if it does? Can I be willing for my certainty to collapse at any moment and to be transformed by that collapse? Might I even fall in love with the process? We'll just have to see, I guess. When I told my mom, who's a lung cancer survivor herself, 12 years out, about Ruth, that wonderfully wise, soulful woman who was waiting for the party to begin, my mom, who's pretty wonderfully wise herself, knowingly said, "Oh, honey, the party's always right now. So be it."